The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This week, it's part two of my conversation with Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Loyal listeners will recall that in part one, Sanho and I discussed the kidnapping of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro by the U.S. military. Let's rejoin that conversation. While the international politics are playing out and the threat of a war that's maybe just a police action, we had a couple of those, right? Anyway, while all that's going on in the international arena and people overseas are dying, Nicolas Maduro is in the United States is going to be tried in federal court, reported to court on, I guess, Monday, January 5th. And there is the parallels are being drawn. People are talking about the 1989 kidnapping of General Manuel Noriega out of Panama by the George H.W. Bush administration, and they're talking out their through their hats. There we go. Not a lot of people talking through their hats about stuff that they're not really very familiar with. As you have mentioned once or twice, I'm older than you. And I was working at National Normal when the general was kidnapped by U.S. forces. Your organization, Institute for Policy Studies, actually has an excellent explainer out there in your Foreign Policy on Focus on the CIA, Contras, gangs, and crack, which discusses, from back in the 90s, which discusses Manuel Noriega. And talk to me for a bit about, for the benefit of listeners who may not know very much about the 1980s, talk to me for a bit about Manuel Noriega and how this is both similar and yet different.
Yeah. So at that time, Noriega was profiting from, allowing drug traffickers through Panama. George Bush led an invasion and captured him. They cornered him in the Vatican embassy, blasted, they used psychological warfare, blasted heavy metal music until they drove them nuts. It was almost comical, trying to get this guy out of the Vatican embassy. But anyway, that was very different. At the time, the U.S. had a military base in Panama. It was a much smaller operation, much smaller country. You could drive across Panama, in a couple of hours. It's very different in logistically speaking and militarily speaking. The principle is similar in the sense that, yeah, Noriega allowed transit of drugs. Not a producer of drugs in any degree, certainly no fentanyl in Venezuela in terms of the illicit markets, etc. And most of the cocaine was going to Europe, not to the United States. But so they did, there are some drug charges against him. I'm not saying they're not serious. I'm not saying they shouldn't be investigated, etc. But our allies are far bigger drug traffickers than our enemies. And yet our allies do things that are mind-bogglingly corrupt under our noses and have throughout the drug war. So let's go back 25 years. You remember the movie, James Spader and Traffic? Yeah, Steven Soderbergh's movie, Traffic, about drug trafficking. It came out in 1999 or 2000, caused a big stir in Washington because they got actual senators and members of Congress to play themselves in this movie. But Michael Douglas plays the fictional drug czar in this movie. And he goes down to Mexico and meets with his counterpart, General Salazar. And he puts his arm around General Salazar, who's their main counter-narcotics guy. And he says, "This is a man we can do business with. I trust General Salazar," etc. Gives him a big bear hug. And it turns out General Salazar in this movie was a drug trafficker himself. That incident was based on reality. That actually happened to General Barry McCaffrey, who was Bill Clinton's drug czar, did exactly that. He went to Mexico, hugged his counterpart, the general who turned out to be working for the cartels, right? We can talk about Vladimiro Montesinos in Peru, the head of intelligence, who was, up to his eyeballs in drug trafficking money. Or we could talk about Genaro Garcia Luna, the Mexican security minister, who was convicted in also in the Southern District of New York court a couple of years ago and is now in prison for being a major drug trafficker. So this happens over and over and over again, and including with Colombia, which has been our main drug war partner for the past quarter century in South America, and the largest recipient of U.S. aid in the continent. And Colombia has had an awful, awful human rights record, number one. Lots of corruption around the drug issue. And with the election of President Petro a few years ago, this is the first Colombian government, the first progressive Colombian government in its entire history, who has tried to reform a lot of this crazy BS in these policies. But previous presidential administrations in Colombia have been involved in drug trafficking, working with paramilitary drug traffickers, etc. President Uribe was up to his eyeballs in that sort of thing under Plan Colombia. And so, the idea that government officials could be corrupt is not new. And certainly Maduro, I'm not a fan of. He's very problematic, a terrible human rights record, responsible for lots of murders, and is also corrupt. But on the grand in the grand scale of things, he is a minor player in the drug economy compared to some of these others, and a relatively small offender when you line it up against some of these major collaborators and corrupt allies that we've had over the decades. President Petro, I would also add, has spoken out forcefully and decisively against drug trafficking organizations, particularly the biggest drug scandal in Colombian history, and the biggest one to my knowledge, worldwide. The outrageous nature, the size of the corruption was spectacular. So when he was a senator in 2000s, in the mid 2000s, he uncovered and blew the whistle on what was called the parapolitics scandal in Colombia, where the right-wing paramilitary death squads, who were fighting the guerrillas and aligned with the government, were carrying out the biggest drug operations. They were smuggling more drugs than even the guerrillas and the other drug lords. And they had a political project, and they had bought off a lot of local politicians and the National Congress, so that when he spoke out, about a third of the Congress was either under indictment or behind bars for drug trafficking or accepting money from drug traffickers. He blew the whistle on that. And in 2007, my office gave Senator Gustavo Petro at the time our Letelier Moffett Human Rights Award for exposing the parapolitics scandal. He has put his life on the line so many times for denouncing these organizations. And when he was, when I, you know, I've known him since 2001, and when I've seen him in the Congress in Colombia, he could not stand near a window because the assassins would get him. When he came to accept his award in Washington, D.C., he was here for a few days, and one of the things he asked to do was to go pick up my friend's daughter from daycare, right? And my friend was like, "Why were you interested in picking up my daughter from daycare?" He says, "That's one of the things I miss most about Colombia. I can't do that for security reasons. I cannot pick up my own children from school. I cannot have any kind of routine in my life. I cannot go the same way home every night, because the moment you develop a pattern in your life and your behaviors, that's when the assassins will get you." And so ever since then, he has lived on a knife's edge, facing constant death threats because he's pissed off so many right-wing death squads and drug traffickers. And this is the man. Donald Trump last night on Air Force One said, "This guy's running a drug mill. He's pushing drugs onto the United States. He's a drug peddler." This guy has put his life on the line. And he's reforming drug policy. Very important, right? He's the first Colombian president to say, "We just don't punish people and spray them with poisons like a cockroach to try to, make drugs disappear. That will never work. You have to do, basic investment in rural areas. You have to give farmers another way out. And so he's been trying to decriminalize and help these farmers, while at the same time finding ways to regulate cocaine and these drugs. So he's looking for a way out, and this is who Donald Trump accused of just a racist slur last night, just saying all Colombians are drug traffickers, basically. That's what he said. That's what he meant when he calls Gustavo Petro a drug peddler and operating drug mills. That's so disgusting, and it's such an outrageous lie. I'm sorry, I really get this emotional, but that really f me off.
Understandable, understandable. I mean, the reason I mentioned Noriega in part is, I mean, we know a lot about what he was up to because we were doing that with him. It was U.S. agencies like the CIA and our officials who were responsible for abetting. I mean, we worked directly with him while he's committing these crimes. So we sure as heck. I mean, the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Narcotics, and International Operations at the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, the Kerry Subcommittee, issued a report in December of 1988 entitled "Drugs, Law Enforcement, and Foreign Policy," and the Panama section is lengthy.
Yeah, readers can, yeah, your listeners can go to the CIA's FOIA website if they want and look up a document. It's the famous MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, between the Attorney General and the head of the CIA under Ronald Reagan. And they clarify that there are standard issues where, State Department and government employees, if they see, criminal activity overseas with partners that we deal with, if they're engaged in kidnapping, money laundering, et cetera, they have to report all of these crimes. And they explicitly carve out in this memorandum of understanding, they don't have to report drug activities, drug trafficking. That's just insane. This is just say no, drug war Ronald Reagan. His attorney general is telling the CIA, and the CIA are saying, we don't have to talk about this. We can look the other way while, and what they were doing was trying to fund the Contra terrorists in Nicaragua using drug funds and then later selling missiles to Iran and Iran-Contra. The hypocrisy is just staggering. Anyway.
Now, Honduras, El Salvador, Panama, Nicaragua, I mean, all over Central America, we're running guns and we're running drugs, and there may be there's a cutout. Oh, cool. So they hired somebody to act as a cutout, isn't that? So that keeps our hands clean, and it doesn't. That Kerry Subcommittee report, which is quite extensive, is available at the Internet Archive at archive.org. Just look up Kerry report and drugs, and you will find it. And it's the thing, all this information, it's one of the most frustrating things. My thing is facts, right? And as I keep pointing out, the facts don't mean diddly. They don't, if the facts affected policy, then we'd have a much different world. It's just, the reality is that it's based on, a lot of times, it's emotion. And it's stuff that... I have you on. Why am I babbling? There's other stuff that I want to ask you about. There are other.
But there's one caveat I would add for listeners. Not only is this outrageous, but a lot of conspiracy theorists have really all over this, right? And so there's so many conspiracy theories that are wrong, made up, fabricated, used for their own political purposes, dealing with drugs and the government in the 1980s, et cetera. So when you research this, use reputable sources. The National Security Archive, nothing new with NSA, is a great resource, and they archive declassified documents. You could go to the primary sources yourself and study it yourself. Try to avoid internet conspiracy mongers. That's all I have to say about that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's... The Kerry Subcommittee report is great reading, and what you said, go to the source, for heaven's sake. Hey, while I have you, there's something I need to ask you about. You live in D.C., so I was wondering what things are like there. In particular, I heard about this event coming up on January 20th, the Walkout on Fascism. Free D.C. Project is doing some kind of a thing. Do you know anything about that? Are you walking out on January 20th?
I have not heard about it. There is so much going on in Washington. But since Friday, I've been doing nothing but Venezuela. I made the very bad judgment call of checking my phone at 2 a.m. on Friday night before going to sleep, which is when the first bombs fell in Venezuela. And I've barely slept since then. Anyway, good to be with you.
This is my conversation with Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Have there been, were there protests? I remember back in 19, God, so long ago. I remember back in the previous century when the bombs started falling on Iraq in the first Gulf War. The streets were full of protesters. One of my housemates got arrested that night outside Lafayette Park. What's it been like there?
There are always protests in Washington. I just want to emphasize to listeners, protesting is important, showing up is important, but it's even more effective, I think, if you do it locally, because all politics is local. You have great influence over your legislators. You don't have great influence over other people's legislators. So do stuff in the district that, you know, hold your own representatives accountable. They will listen to you. But if you're outside their district, they don't have to listen to you, and they don't. And so people think, oh, I don't have money to go all the way to Washington, D.C. to protest. No, do it at the state house. Do it at the state offices of your representatives. Make them feel it and let them know there are people in their district who are angry about these issues.
Right on. I was going to ask what else is on your radar, but I'm guessing this has been pretty much it for the last couple. I do want to ask you what you think about the kerfuffle, the executive order that they issued back a month ago. Gosh, all the way back December 18th it was. There's an executive order that told the Justice Department, actually told the Attorney General to complete the process of deciding on this rescheduling petition that had been filed by the previous administration, that's all it really said. That was back in December 18th. We are recording this on January 5th. Weed is still in Schedule 1. The DEA has no administrative law judges. Did you know that? The last administrative law judge on staff at the DEA retired in July of last year, effective July 31st. So since August of last year, every proceeding for that administrative court has been stayed. The other one was the weed rescheduling had been stayed since January, but that's everything's been stayed there. They have no administrative law judge. So I guess they'd first have to hire one. But anyway,
so many positions are unstaffed into this administration. They just don't care, and they're not going to staff them, including Western Hemisphere, a director in the State Department. Which might be nice to have when you're waging war and threatening to bomb all these countries in the Western Hemisphere. You might want to have someone on staff who's an expert in this kind of area. But I digress.
So DEA administrative law judge is definitely up there on the priority list, you think? Mm. Yeah, that was, in case we folks need to know, that was sarcasm on my part. I do need to point out if I make a joke. I don't do jokes, so if I ever do... kid in some kind of way, I really do need to point out that was, and in this case, that really was sarcasm. When I say, gosh, I'm sure that'll work out well, that is sarcasm. You know, what could possibly go wrong? That's sarcasm. I saw that on Blue Sky the other day. Somebody was well, what are you trying to say? It's like, dude, the that'll turn out well is a sign of sarcasm. It was a translation thing, that, you know, idiom. They don't really translate.
Too bad there are no emojis on radio, unfortunately.
But it's true. Okay, I've had you on for quite a while. Again, we're speaking with Sanho Tree, the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, long time military historian, drug policy thinker. Advocate, genius. I guess say the smartest guy in the room. It's been so cool. How do people keep up with your work there at the Institute? How do people keep up with your work, your handle, and all that?
So I'm on Blue Sky, no longer on Twitter. I have an account there, but I don't use it. But on Blue Sky, just search San Ho, and you'll find me. I'm the only one there.
I didn't want to get into the argument with somebody, but I went out to see, I understand how if you've secured your brand, like on Twitter, my name is my Twitter handle. I got a work project that work project name is the Twitter handle. There are other, a lot of big companies, their Twitter handle is their corporate name. So if you delete that, it's up for grabs and anybody can grab it, which means that following, then somebody can tweet out with your old handle and maybe even using a photo that looks like it might be you, some kind of heinous stuff. And you've got to go through and explain to people, it's like, this wasn't me, I deleted my account months ago. And how do you prove that exactly? I understand wanting to hold on to the brand, not delete the thing entirely. Because if you do, somebody else will pick it up and you'll be having to explain yourself. You've had other people smearing stuff on the walls.
There are a number of reasons I haven't deleted my account on Twitter, and I think it's important to talk about. Number one is that AI is trolling everything, right? Whether you give permission or not, they're scraping the internet to learn. And if progressives delete all their accounts on Twitter, then Grok is going to learn from fascists and only fascists. And that doesn't help anyone. That just accelerates the destruction of our society. So to the extent you have sane content on your account, maybe leave it up there and try to restore some balance to this. But more importantly, I was on Twitter for 15 years, right? And I tweeted a lot, and I got 15,000 followers, so roughly 1,000 followers per year, right? And I thought that was a lot, and so it was hard to leave Twitter and move over to Blue Sky. What I discovered upon moving to Blue Sky is that we have been suppressed, progressives have been suppressed on Twitter savagely for years. So instead of taking, a year to get 1,000 followers on Blue Sky, I get that in a month. Same posting habits, right? Nothing changed between my habits on Twitter versus Blue Sky. And yet I'm just getting 10 times or 12 times the number of followers. And it's reaching so many more people. And that just tells me that Elon has been suppressing the hell out of our accounts on Twitter. And so to the extent I have posted some things about urgent updates about Venezuela on Twitter, it gets very few views, even though I still have technically 15,000 followers. It's not reaching people. So those of you who are still hanging on to Twitter because you think, oh, yeah, I need to save my audience. No, no, no. You're being suppressed. Give it up. Move on. You'll build bigger followings on Blue Sky or elsewhere where a fascist isn't in control of the app.
I don't have nearly your follower count as... Anyway, I don't know nearly your follower count, but I have noticed that there's a significant difference, certainly in engagement. I mean, I struggle for anybody to notice a thing I say on Twitter back in the when I was using it, and I actually get engagement on posts on Blue Sky, and it's rather heartening,
Yeah.
I mean, there are certainly bots. There are bots and trolls on there as much as anywhere. I do like that. I do like the environment. I also use Facebook still, which I know. I'm of an age where how else am I going to keep up with the surviving members of my high school graduating class?
Oh, my. Yeah.
All right, so any closing thoughts for the listeners?
It's that old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, right? And we're living in a very interesting time right now. And oh my God, try to stay engaged. Try not to tune out. It's tempting, I know. It's overwhelming, I know. But this is the most important fight of my lifetime, of your lifetime, of any of our lifetimes, I suspect. It's all on the table right now, and it could go badly if we don't stick together.
You know, there is one other thing I wanted to ask you just real quick, and I will use this on one or another show, probably more than once. Sanho, as you know, this isn't people may be listening to this via podcast, but this is a show produced for radio and distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. I did this as a volunteer because I think that community radio is important. What do you think about community radio?
Oh God, it's so important. Community media in general, local newspapers, community radio, local public television. This is time to support your locals, right? Especially when it comes to local corruption, covering these kinds of issues that eventually get national attention. If you don't have local, then that stuff doesn't percolate up, and it just allows for so much more corruption and misconduct. Keep your local media alive and vibrant, and donate to local radio, and support public broadcasting in all its forms.
Thank you. And Sanho Tree, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was my conversation with Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hey friends, before we go, a quick update. I'm recording this on the morning of January 13th. In our conversation, I asked Sanho about the executive order on rescheduling. At the time of our interview, there had been no motion, there were no administrative law judges at the Drug Enforcement Administration, and marijuana was still in Schedule 1. Well, here's an update. Nothing has changed. Marijuana is still in Schedule 1. There are no administrative law judges working at the DEA currently. None at all. All actions before that agency are still stayed. Nothing has changed. That executive order was useless garbage. Dollars to donuts. The Trump administration will do nothing to move marijuana out of Schedule 1. It's a farce.
And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Now that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for nonprofit community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support public media and local community radio. Become members. Become volunteers. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy. We'll